a seal out of it. No, you don't just form it into any shape you want to form it into, right? We have certain rules for interpreting, and we look at the context. How many different types of contexts are there? Because some of you were good to have the ladies join us. You're finished now, so welcome. So if you didn't hear me say this before, those of you who were here before, remind us all how many different contexts do we have. When I talk about looking at the context, what am I referring to exactly? How many different contexts do we have?
Historical.
Historical context, yeah, that's really important. If you don't know the historical, because we have to cross all these bridges, right? We're going from 2022 now. We're going not only a different culture, a different historical period. We're having to cross all these bridges. So how many bridges are we having to cross? We mentioned, Pastor Justin mentioned history. Historical context, what else?
Culture,
yeah, that's a huge one. We talked about greet one another with a holy kiss, which I don't usually get too many holy. I get one once in a while, but I won't say from whom, but she knows who she is. Why not? Well, we have different cultures. Some cultures still do that. So historical context, cultural context, what else?
Geographical,
that's really critical because there's some passages depends on that. Matthew 24, this isn't cultural but or necessarily historical, but Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse, this is a prediction of the tribulation, first half, second half, etc., second coming, eight parabolic exhortations after that. But he says, pray that your flight may not be in the winter. So that's where it's helpful to know a little bit about Israel, what the winters are like, why did he say that? Or on the Sabbath, he said, in Matthew 24. Mm-hmm. How about literary context? What does that mean? What's literary context?
What type of writing is it?
Is it poetry?
What type of writing? So how would that be important? What type of writing?
Because sometimes with poetry, it might be metaphorical.
Right.
With other types of literature are not.
Right. Yeah. And how about genre? What does that mean? G-E-N-R-E. Why is it important to know the type of genre that the passage is, the framework of the passage? And how would that matter? If you're looking at Proverbs compared to narrative, why would you have to switch gears going from Proverbs to Genesis through all the books that we have that are historical compared to a parable? How would that, so how do you have to change your hermeneutics when you're looking at different genres? How do you interpret a parable? Anyone have a brief answer for me? What?
Not on all fours.
Yeah, as one of my professors used to say, who's now 93, don't make a parable walk on all fours. Don't take every little detail and try to figure out, no, that's not the point of a... Roy Zook has a book on hermeneutics. He was at Dallas, and it talks about you find the one main point of the parable. Don't try to match it to every little detail. Proverbs, you have to know how to interpret. So these are all things that we talked about before. These are bridges we're crossing to try to figure out, and our goal is to go back in time, look at this passage in Malachi 3, figure out what did it mean in the original context. So in order to cross these bridges, and there's also a language bridge. What was it written in? Did Paul write this in King James English? Babylon B, which is my favorite source for the news, Babylon B, it's all satire, had an article on Paul's original King James is being sold on eBay for, I don't know, $1,000. Yeah. Don't go try to find it. It's a joke. So we have language barriers. What language barriers do we have? We're going from English to mostly Hebrew. There's maybe 9, 10 chapters that are in Aramaic, part of Daniel, part of Ezra, one verse in Jeremiah 10, verse 11, Jeremiah 10, 11, a couple words in Genesis, and Greek. So we have to cross those bridges. So getting back to what we were talking about, so Malachi 3, we looked at how some pastors use this. So bring the whole tithe in the storehouse. Now, Beth said they want more money. So what does she mean by that? Can anyone, Clara, I know she can, but or you
well,
can clarify.
Well, I'm thinking of pastors like, well, I'm not going to say any names, but prosperity.
Yeah.
Pastors who would quote verses like that and say, if you give this, then you know, your money will be doubled or tripled or whatever.
But it's actually more than that, too. It's not only your money will be tripled. If you send me your money, then your money, well, come on, if you send them your money, whose money is going to be tripled?
Yeah.
Theirs, right? Why do you think Cathro Dollar? And I'm not picking on, when I mention a name, by the way, don't give me a hard time, because if they make it public, guess what? I'm going to. If it's Twitter, if it's Facebook, if it's Instagram, if it's a sermon audio, if it's YouTube, if it's a journal article, once they make it public, I don't put down the person, but I will warn you about some of these. Oh, I need 60, she agrees, $60 million to buy a private jet.
Yeah.
So where do you think they get the money from? It's some people that, now getting back to the question, bring your whole tithe into the storehouse. So how would a pastor use that phrase? What do they mean? What would they use it for? And what should you not be giving your money to if you're a pastor misusing this passage? Not a parachurch. See what I mean? Bring your whole tithe into the storehouse. So if you're the pastor saying that to you, I teach my Cornerstone students how to debate by asking questions. They're getting really good at it because we do it every day in class. So I would say to them, so girls, what would you say to me if I was saying this to you? And I do this all the time in class. Okay, I'm going to act like I'm a prosperity teacher. And I will. And I tell them all these things. Okay, what do you respond to me back? How do you respond, and what questions would you ask me? Well, if I were you, if I was a student, I would say, so what do you mean by storehouse? The pastor says, bring your whole tithe into the storehouse. Where's your storehouse? Is that a pantry? Is that a...
It's supposed to be in heaven.
So getting back to the, heaven, but we'll talk about what this means in Malachi 3. So in other words, don't give your offerings and your tithes to any other organization except our church. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they get more money that way. But God doesn't honor when people are misusing passages. Again, this is not like silly putty. I know silly putty is fun to play with and shape it in whatever form you want. But not when it comes to hermeneutics, which is a fancy word for saying the science and art of interpreting the Bible. It's a science in that we have rules, and it's an art because it takes practice. What happens when you stop practicing your piano and 30 years later you go to the piano and try to play something? Probably can't do it anymore because you need to practice like we were made to do when we were little, 30 minutes on the piano. Okay, so will man rob God? Okay, when it says, then in tithes and offerings, now, did you talk about what that meant for an Old Testament believer? And how is that different from a New Testament believer? Are we required to tithe? Yes or no? And support your answer, which I would say in class. Yeah, you had a... Audrey, you
well,
had a... I'm picking on Audrey. You talked.
We did Nehemiah.
Okay,
so
good.
We went through this, and their tithes, well, in Nehemiah 10, it talks about the first fruit of their fruit, their dough, their fruit of every tree, the new wine, the oil to the priests, and the priests and the son of Aaron, I think,
mm-hmm.
receive the tithes, and then they give a portion of it to the Levites. I mean,
right.
to the priests.
Right.
The Levites receive it, and then they give
right.
a portion of it to the priests.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually went to the storehouse that Tobiah made his house
right.
in. And so it was an actual storehouse.
Right.
He wanted everything to, it was for the singers and the
mm-hmm.
gatekeepers. And
mm-hmm.
So that was their tithe.
Remember someone got kicked out? Maybe Tobiah, right?
Yeah.
We like to see that. Don't mess with Nehemiah.
Yeah.
He was staying in the storehouse, you know. So, very good. So, how was this a voluntary thing then, or was it mandatory?
It was mandatory.
So it's kind of like our your taxes that are due in a couple months, right? So we're getting together our stuff for the accountant. Due in April, is that mandatory or is it voluntary? Oh, I'm just going to choose to pay my... Well, you can do that, but you're going to have the IRS knocking on your door and... We might be doing, I do prison ministry, so we might be visiting prison. Tell me where you are and we'll visit you. So how about here? Is this voluntary or is this mandatory?
Mandatory.
It's mandatory.
Oh, okay, so see the difference? When you were in school, you wrote a compare and contrast essays. Remember doing that?
Yeah.
Compare and contrast essay. So tell me how it's the same. Tell me how it's different. We already saw one difference between a New Testament believer and an Old Testament believer. This is not, for us, it's no one's making you bring a tithe or whatever, an offering. It's voluntary, but for an Old Testament believer, and what happened when they chose not to do it? What happened to the country and the teaching? What did the Levites do then?
They got cursed.
They got cursed. Why?
They didn't keep the covenant.
That's a good point. We're going to talk about that. So they were supposed to, they were like, if you don't support our pastor and he doesn't make enough money, because 1 Timothy 5 talks about an elder is worth double honor. It's worth double honor, especially an elder who's preaching and teaching. And the same verse that we talked about before in 1 Corinthians 9, if you weren't here, we talked about this is the food sacrificed to idols. This is like our movies, yoga, gray areas, social drinking. 1 Corinthians 8 to 10, chapter 9, Paul says, we have the right to do such and such and such, but I'm choosing not to do certain things for the sake of loving my brother, which is the problem with the Corinthian church. So in chapter 9, he says, we have the freedom to do this. And then he quotes in Deuteronomy, you don't muzzle an ox. Remember that verse? When it's threshing. So an ox is working, he can eat on, he or she can eat on a job, right? Because a worker is worth as, 1 Timothy 5, verse, not in front of me, 8 or 9, an elder is worth double honor, it says, especially one who's preaching and teaching. Then it quotes, guess what? Paul quotes in that same verse. Isn't that interesting? From Deuteronomy. So what happens if you don't support your pastor, and instead of doing what he's supposed to be doing, he gets a full-time job, right? And then maybe his work suffers because he's trying to support himself. That's what happened with the Levites, right?
Yeah.
What was their job? What's their role in the Old Testament? I think you might have said it, right? The job of a Levite? What were they supposed to do as far as the people? How were they helping the people?
They were leading the worship.
Leading worship, right? They were teaching. So if they're not able to, if you don't support them through these, not voluntary, these mandatory tithes, then their
quality of teaching goes down.
Yeah, the quality of teaching goes down. The people suffer. We have these blessings and curses of the law. So we heard before the Mosaic Covenant. What's the Mosaic Covenant? You see it in your notes that Malachi 3 was written to the Jewish nation who was still under the Mosaic Covenant. So the blessings and curses of the law, what's that?
Deuteronomy 28.
Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, two key chapters. Blessings and curses of the law. What was that all about? And how's that different? Remember the compare and contrast essay that we had to do? How's that different than compare it with and contrast with the Abrahamic covenant? What's the Abrahamic covenant? How is that different from the Mosaic covenant?
Abrahamic covenant's unconditional, but the Mosaic covenant
was conditional.
Which means what?
What's unconditional?
Unconditional means God is going to see to it that this is kept. Conditional means it has an if clause. If you do this, then God will do such and such.
Right, right.
God will respond in a certain way.
Right.
Based on how Israel, if they obeyed or not.
Right, very good. So the unconditional covenant with Abraham. Remember when the smoking oven, the pieces, the animals that were cut? And typically there'd be two people walking down between the pieces. So if you don't, you and I walk down the, I'm going to pick on you, you don't mind you. So if you don't keep your end, or I don't keep my end, the same thing happens to us that happened to the animals. And knowing people, knowing me, I'm probably not going to keep my end of it. I will for a while, but not. But Abraham was put to sleep. Only God, in the form of a smoking oven, went down between the pieces. Why did God do that? He knows us. We're not going to probably keep our end of it very long. But how about the Mosaic Covenant? Can man keep the Mosaic Covenant?
No.
That was the purpose of the law, to show people that you can't do it. Just and I were talking about Romans 7, especially the second half of 7, Romans 7. You can't do it. Whenever you see a sign that says, don't step on the grass, I had no intention of stepping on the grass until I saw that sign.
Don't step on the grass.
Don't. I never would have thought to do that. But now that I see the sign, don't look in this cupboard. I didn't care until now. Now I'm wondering what's in that cupboard. Don't look in this cookie jar. Don't eat the cookies in the jar. If you're not looking, I probably will. So this is man's nature. We can't keep the law. You can't do it. But that was the point of it, right? To show us that we can't do it. So the Mosaics, what are some of the curses of the law? You mentioned Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26. What are some of the curses of the law, blessings of the law?
He was going to spew them out of the land.
Yeah,
he didn't keep
right.
The Sabbaths.
Yeah. So being in the land wasn't necessarily their right. Now he's going to give them the land, but the remaining in the land. So it's all these blessings and curses. So you see in your notes I have in the first paragraph, the majority of Malachi was to the priesthood. See Malachi 2:1. So the focus of Malachi 1:6-14 was on the pollution of the priesthood in Judah. And it talks about the offerings in chapter 1. It talks about sacrifices. You're taking your animal, which is a disease, and you're thinking, well, what do I do with this diseased animal? I don't know. Give it to God. Would you give it to your governor? I hope not.
Got a couple bald eagles that are enjoying one.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Oh,
but you wouldn't give your diseased animal, right, to the governor. You bring your best. So it talks about offering your best offerings to the Lord. So tithing. Now, how many tithes did the Old Testament believers have to give? Anyone know? I know I saw Beth put up a couple of fingers because she knows the answer. But anyone else know the answer to that question?
Three.
Three, exactly. Dad said three. So we have one that was 10%, another one that's 10%, and then we have one that's every 3 years. So we're talking about 23%. Is it just money? Do they have bills back then that they're giving checks, writing checks out, and credit card scans and all that? No. So what are they bringing for their offerings other than money?
Livestock.
Yeah, livestock and a lot of different things. So tithing, you see in the second paragraph in your notes, first page, second, I have a different pagination with mine, was the Mosaic law given to Aaron. So we saw before Numbers 18, Deuteronomy 14, that tithes were given to support the Levites. That was their inheritance because they were serving in the tent of meeting. So we talked about before that when tithes were unpaid, then the priests were deprived and they had to discontinue the ministry and begin farming. Is there anything wrong with farming?
No.
No, there's a lot of farmers and ranchers around here.
Oh, good.
Right? You used to do that, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you? So there's nothing wrong with farming. Only if your job is to serve and teach, and then you go back to farming. Everyone runs in the lane, right? Mm-hmm. So then the ministry suffers. So the nation's religious life is negatively impacted, and the poor and strangers suffered. See Nehemiah 13, 10, and 11. Now, before we go on, the next paragraph you see about these required tithe offerings, a tenth of the produce of the land, the tenth of the tithe required to the priests and Levites, the third year tithe to be dispensed in the person's hometown to be consumed by the local landless inhabitants and given to the socially disadvantaged. Now we have just people given money. What's the problem with that? Just hand people money.
They don't want to work.
They don't want to work. Why work when you can get more money just staying at home? Right? That's why a lot of the businesses can't find enough workers. I returned a product back, and this company wrote me back and said, it's going to take up to 6 weeks to process your refund. Why? I don't know. COVID, they can't get enough workers. Why work when I can get paid to sit at home? So did the Old Testament, they just give people money? Oh, here's some food. Here's a pantry. What did they have to do? Anyone know? I'll give you a hint. Book of Ruth, chapter 2. Gleaning. What's gleaning mean? Yeah, the leftovers. Why not just hand them the leftovers? Here's some leftovers. Just what happens to a person's value as a person? A person might think they like this idea of just of not doing anything and getting free food. Now, certain people that can't work, that physically can't do it, that's different, right? Different story. So what happens to the person's value as a person if you just hand it to them and they can do it, though? Doesn't it go down? It really suffers. Now, did you talk about your groups? So how is a New Testament believer compared to Old Testament believer? You talked about it's not required by us, is it? So does the New Testament teach tithing? Be careful how you answer this. This is kind of a semi-trick. That's why I said it's a semi-trick question. I do it on purpose in class. I try to mess people up. I'm sorry. I enjoy it. I asked the class, so are we required to tithe? Or I'll say to them, do you realize that we're not required to tithe? I just look around to see what their response is. And they're happy. I said, no, don't look happy. I'm not finished yet.
Yeah.
Now, what do I mean by that? Does the New Testament mention tithe? You can do a search. You can go to Bible Gateway. If you don't know how to go to Bible Gateway, at the top, you can either type in a passage or type in a key word. You can choose a translation, because underneath the pull-down menu, the next one underneath it, you can. There's other ones, too, that you can do this. Type in the word tithe, and then on the right-hand side, you'll see all the books of the Bible, and you can narrow down the New Testament. Do it sometime. How many times does the New Testament mention tithe? Anyone know? And when it mentions it, is it negative or is it positive? Yeah, well, I'll give you a hint. The Pharisees, not all the Pharisees were bad. There was one group of Pharisees that were good. Most of them were, usually it's negative. But the Pharisees, when I say swallow the gnat, no, swallow the camel, strain the gnat at the gnat, swallow the camel. What do I mean by that? Strain out the gnat. You want to swallow a gnat? No, and then you swallow. So you strain out a gnat, and you swallow a camel. What do I mean by that? Because Jesus is condemning the Pharisees for that.
Spices comes to mind.
Spices. So they talked about they were tithing certain spices. Is there anything wrong with doing that? No, but read the whole context. What were they doing? They were tithing.
They were neglecting.
Yeah, they were weighing on their scale. Oh, I got to give God like 8 grams. So did I just go to 9 grams? No, I'll take out 1 gram. I got to give God exactly. So they're so, this minutia, they were focused on minutia, but then they were swallowing a camel. So what does he mean by that? I think you said it. They were neglecting these huge things that they had a way to get around supporting the parents. Because Mark 7, the disciples get accused of not washing their hands. What kind of people were they not washing their hands? The disciples weren't washing their hands? Thinking, that's disgusting. It's not what it sounds like. You know, the Pharisees, if you read the Talmud, it's mind-blowing. It really is. It's completely mind-blowing. If you read all the stuff that they had people do, you take an eggshell worth of water and you pour it here and it runs down your hand. and then you pour, and then you go this way. It's like, really? Why not just do it the old-fashioned way? They had so much minutiae, so they were doing these little things, but then they had a way to get around supporting their parents.
They were neglecting love.
Neglecting justice, love, right. Yeah, and Jesus mercy. Condemns them. And he says it's not what goes in the man that defiles a man. Thus, and then Mark says, thus declaring all foods clean. I mean, a Jewish believer can eat kosher if they want to. No one's stopping that person from doing it. Do they have to? No. Are they justified by doing that? No. Are they a better Christian because they're doing that? Certainly not. Can they choose to do it because of their health? Yes. But keep quiet about it. Oh, it's too bad that Justin isn't as spiritual as I am. Isn't that too bad? Because I mean kosher, he's not. No, that's not, it's not correct. So they were, he says, it's not what goes in the man that defiles a man. Because what goes in the man, I'm not trying to be crude, this is from the passage, it just goes in the toilet, right? Goes in the toilet, you flush, it goes down. But it's what comes out of the heart that defiles a man. See what he's focusing on? He said, you're like a whitewashed tomb. What does that mean? Matthew 23, where he blasts the Pharisees. And if you read the Talmud, they blast themselves. This is what Will Varner shows in his book, Passionate About the Passion Week. Dr. Will Varner, he shows basically that there's one group of Pharisees that weren't bad, and there are some parts of the Talmud that puts themselves down. So when Matthew was blasting the Pharisees in Matthew 23, that's really in harmony with the Talmud because they really put themselves down. So he said, you're like whitewashed tombs. What do you mean by that?
Looks good on the outside, empty on the inside.
Yeah, and what's on the inside?
Nothing.
Nothing. A stinky, you know, body. At least for about a week it's stinky. After that it's, you know. Remember John 11? Oh, don't raise Lazarus by now. It's been 4 days. He stinketh. You got to love the King James, right? He stinketh. Not stinks. He stinketh. Say it right. Okay, so the Old Testament, the Jewish people are required to give a total of 23%. So getting back to my question, are New Testament believers required to tithe? Is Paul or Peter or John or Jude or whatever in the epistles command a believer to tithe? No, what are we required to do?
Give to our hurts.
You give generously. That's why when I say to classes, oh, you're not required to tithe, and they look about happy. Because they're thinking they can keep their money. No, I didn't say that. I'm not finished yet. If you're Jeff Bezos, who's worth, I don't care, but $170 billion, he's given 10%. What does he have left? Do the math. $153 billion. Oh, that's hurting, right? Even 99.9, get your calculator out. If he gave 99.99, if he was a believer, giving 99.9% of that much, he's still not hurting. So it's nothing to do with an amount, right? It's whatever you're giving generously, because you're giving God off of the top. You're not, I'm going to pay all my bills, and then we'll see what I have at the end. Is God going to honor that? Is he going to bless you? You don't do it to be blessed, but no, he's not going to honor that. We give off at the top, generously. And it could mean if you're supporting a whole family, and you're a single parent, and you're making $15 an hour at McDonald's, you might give way less than 10%. And for that person, that could be a sacrificial. Remember the widow's mite? Mm-hmm. For her, that was a huge. So it's not the amount. And the best passage as far as extensive in the New Testament is 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, where Paul talks about giving. And it's the most extensive in terms of the amount of teaching. So the tithes and contributions fall in your notes there. We actually very similar to a tax. We talked about that. And Malachi 3:8, where we probably those which were used to support the Levites. So 3:10 mentions food in my house. What does that mean? Storehouse. What did they use a storehouse for in the temple? The treasury rooms. Well, so the Levites, right. Right, so it's 1 Kings 7, 2 Chronicles 31, Nehemiah 10, Nehemiah, a lot of passages there. So they literally were food for the priests and Levites. Remember 1 Samuel, Eli's sons that were doing things they shouldn't have been doing? Not only were they sleeping with the women, which is why God appears to Samuel in chapter 3. 1 Samuel, this is a free side comment, but it says in 1 Samuel 3 that the Lord stood in the room, which is very, very interesting. I like to ask Jewish people that. How can the Lord stand in the room? I thought you can't see the Lord. He can't. Then how can he stand in the room? Anyway, so he appears to, he can if God becomes a man, which he did in the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. But getting back to the point, God tells Samuel, and he confronts Eli. Remember he confronts Eli? He wasn't disciplining his sons. Not only were they doing things with the women, but they were doing things with the offerings you can read in 1 Samuel that were horrible. So God's not going to honor them. So the storehouse is not something that a pastor should be using. Oh, don't give any money to any other, don't give money to a parachurch organization. Bring it all and give to this church. Well, whether the person says it or not, whether you agree or disagree with that comment, the problem is not only the comment, but it's saying a comment and then you're supposedly backing it up by using Malachi 3. See what I mean? You make a comment and then you back it up. Oh, here's what supports what I'm saying, Malachi 3. And you're hoping that people don't know the context.
Right.
Because before Wycliffe did the first English translation, and I think it was 1384, if you try to read that, it's almost impossible to read. Even 1611 is not easy. And the King James we have now is not the 1611. It's 100 and some years after that. So Wycliffe, before he did Wycliffe, the people didn't know any. They didn't know the Bible. And the Catholic priests liked that. Why? Because it made the people dependent upon that they could tell them whatever they wanted. Purgatory and all this stuff that Andy Woods gets into in that book that's out there. I hope you get it. It's right there on the table. Ever Reforming. It's a fabulous book. If you want to ever use it in a small group, write me because I wrote study questions for the book.
Indulgences.
Indulgences, right. And that's great if you want to pay for St. Peter's Basilica. They took a lot of that money for indulgences. How do you get your loved ones out of purgatory?
Pay money.
And if you can't read the Bible, then you just listen to what the priests say. Once people can start reading the Bible, that's why they got mad. That's why they persecuted Wycliffe and Luther and Tyndale and John, many other people, because that was taking power away from them. So these are all important things. So food in my storehouse, we're talking about food. So the storehouse in Malachi 3:10, this is in your notes, does not refer to the church, but refers to a kind of temple warehouse as a place for storing grain, frankincense, temple vessels, wine, and oil. So why should you bring all the food in the storehouse? The next paragraph, the next point, the next bullet. So the priests would have adequate food because they're not doing a normal job. You know, their job is to teach the people. That's why it says in certain passages that if you don't, when the people weren't doing the right thing, go ahead.
I thought they only worked on the Sabbath.
Yeah, worked on the Sabbath, yeah.
I only work on Sunday.
Yeah, you work on the Sabbath, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my grandfather used to say, don't work on the Sabbath, and he meant Sunday. And I didn't know until I was older that I didn't think to ask Grandpa, isn't the Sabbath from Friday sunset to Saturday sunset? But yeah.
Don't bring that up.
Yeah, it was a bit... I like to ask questions. So it's a great comment. So they're encouraged to, so that the priests have adequate food. So the context indicates Malachi has the blessings of the Mosaic covenant in mind. And you can see Deuteronomy 28. Anyone have that verse? Deuteronomy 28. Can people actually read out of these Bibles, by the way?
I know. Don't remind me. That's not the small print either.
This is the I challenge you to try to read this. I can tell I'm 60 years old. Okay.
We're giving them away for free if you want them.
I think for me it's going to be a problem. I need a magnifying glass. The Lord will open the heavens, the storehouse of his bounty, to send rain on your land in season and to bless all the work of your hands. You will lend to many nations, but will borrow from none. So we have 14 verses of blessing. Guess how many verses for the curses? 55 verses 14. So we have 4 verses of curses for every 1 verse of blessing. So which is more likely? You can guess. To have the curses. So the summary and understanding of the context. Look at this next part there. So we need to make a distinction between Israel's temple and the Christian church. Dr. Tom Constable said, Israel's temple was a depository for the gifts that the Israelites brought to sustain the servants and work of the Lord throughout their nation. The Christian church, however, is different in that we have no central sanctuary, as Israel did, nor does the church have a national homeland. Christians live and serve throughout the world, in contrast to the Israelites, who are to fulfill their mission by serving God within their land. But I'm going to pray now. We got to clean up. And then we're going to finish this next week. So put your notes in your binders. That's why it's not stapled. So you can add it to your binder there. If you need a binder, there's some over here. Hopefully there's enough. And that Laura can make some more. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for all these